So we started this class with what I would call a very high-level discussion of the book of Daniel. We talked about who Daniel was and when he lived. We talked about the geographical setting of the book and how that tied into recent historical events in the nations of Israel and Judah. We talked about how the book itself is written and organized. And maybe we got a little academic there for a little while we talked about the structure of Daniel, the multiple languages that were used to write it, and how the literary device of a chiastic structure kind of directs the reader's attention towards certain things, certain themes in the book of Daniel. And I hope that was helpful for everyone to take a whole class and just talk about what we were about to read. I hope that it added something to your study of Daniel over the past 7 or 8 weeks. I'd like to do the same thing this morning. We are more or less at the halfway point in this study, and it's kind of flown by for me. But this is class number 8, I think, so we're at about the halfway point, and we're also at a transitional point in the book of Daniel. We've finished studying the parts of Daniel that I think most of us have been more familiar with since childhood, and we're about to get into some text that is a little more complicated and a little more difficult, in my opinion. It's more difficult for me. It challenges me more than the rest of the book. So now that we've finished studying the first 6 chapters in detail, the tone of the book is going to change, and the purpose, I think, of the text is going to change here in chapter 7. But up to this point, we've seen a lot. We've seen Daniel live his life. We've seen him deal with different kings in different situations from his late teenage years all the way into his 80s. We've seen Daniel stand before multiple kings, and not just kings, but rulers of the most powerful empire in the world at that time. And we've seen his character. Wouldn't you agree that we have seen aspects of Daniel's character throughout this study? We've seen that Daniel obeys God above men, that he does not shape his faith or his conviction to fit his circumstances or to be more compatible with the government under which he is living. We see Daniel hold to his convictions and hold to his faith as an immovable standard in his life, regardless of what else is said to him or done to him. We see that Daniel has trusted in God above all else, even in times when he has no control. When Daniel lost control, he turned to the one that has control over everything. And we saw that Daniel maintained his relationship with God actively. He put time and effort and thought into his relationship with God, and he cared for it. I think I said something last week along the lines of, you can't get to a point where you're praying 3 times a day without purpose. That is a purposeful habit, and it takes effort to build habits like that. And I think it's fair to say that over the past 6 chapters of this book, we've also seen aspects of God's personality, if you will. You know, we see that God hates a proud heart. And God humbles men when doing so can make a point. And when doing so can emphasize to everybody else that I rule. I rule here and I rule in heaven. Nothing happens on earth without God's permission. And God uses the earth and uses the people in it to accomplish his will one way or another. We saw that God humbled 2 kings to make that point to the people who were alive then and to us today as we study this. So that's sort of a recap of everything we've studied over the past 7 weeks. And so now, as we prepare to go into Daniel 7, like I said a second ago, I'd like to take a whole class and go kind of, you know, go up to 30,000 feet again. I want to take a high-level view of what's about to happen. because the literature, the writings in the second half of Daniel are a totally different type of writing than what we've seen in the first six chapters. Chapter 7 begins a section of Daniel that I would say is as different from the previous six chapters as Revelation is different from the rest of the Bible. It's that kind of a contrast. And we're going to study over the next 7 or 8 weeks a series of visions that contain prophecy that was revealed by God to Daniel. And in some cases, we're going to be given a level of temporal detail that places those visions along the timeline of Daniel's life. So up until this point, Daniel has been fairly linear. We've seen that he's interpreted this vision to this king, and then later on he interprets this vision to this king. I mean, with a few exceptions, it's been a fairly linear timeline. And so now, in these following chapters, we're going to be given some snapshots of what Daniel saw and what was revealed to him at different points in his life, mostly towards the end. And I want to say going into this that we've got to tread carefully, and that's my intention here, because the passages in the second half of Daniel, particularly some passages in Daniel 7, are the grounds for much controversy amongst Christians in the world today. There are different interpretations that have been applied to these verses in different denominations, and it really changes, the interpretation of these passages really change a Christian's worldview, or they have the potential to do that. They can literally make the difference between a Christian believing that God's prophecies that were given to Daniel have already been fulfilled, and we are still waiting on some of them to be fulfilled, and all of the implications that come along with that. Daniel 7 in particular contains imagery that when you interpret it in various ways and when coupled with similar interpretations in the book of Revelation form the basis for several premillennial views that you may or may not be familiar with. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit. In our upcoming study of Daniel 7, I want to do several things that I hope will be helpful to us. I want to compare and contrast some of the various interpretations that have been applied to these passages. And I think doing that calls for a brief detour into Revelation. And some of you are thinking, okay, this again. Here we go. You know, we're going to go into Revelation again. I don't know how long ago it was that that we had a series of lessons on it. You may have been trying to block that out of your mind. I don't know. But that was maybe a year ago, year and a half ago, when we talked about premillennialism. And I also think that this calls for a primer on the kind of writing that we see in Daniel 7 and following. What is this? What are we reading? That's a really, really important question. Daniel 7, specifically, and most of what's in Revelation fall into a particular genre that many would refer to as apocalyptic literature. That's not a label that has been given to these writings by God. That's not a label that you're going to turn to in the Bible. Thus saith the Lord, this is apocalyptic prophecy. It is rather a label that has been applied to Daniel, Revelation, parts of Ezekiel, parts of Zechariah, and several other non-inspired books, as a means to group them in such a way that benefits our study of them. And by grouping them, I think we can take some benefits from that grouping. We can understand a little more about what the original readers of this writing would have understood it to mean, and maybe what they would have expected from it. Daniel 7 in particular is where this is going to start to help us, I think. So as we prepare for that study, I guess you can kind of think of today as preparing for that study, I want us to try to avail ourselves of some tools that we have to try to understand this. The first one is just literally the interpretations that Daniel gives us. That's one thing that makes understanding Daniel 7 a little easier than, say, Revelation. Because in Revelation, you're given these dramatic apocalyptic narratives, and there's these supernatural creatures and supernatural beings, and they're fighting with each other, and horns are growing out of things' heads, and some of the horns are talking and saying things, and you're just going, what on earth is happening here? And at the end of it, it's on to the next chapter. What's nice about Daniel, in a way, at least for us as 21st century Bible students, is that he stops and goes, this is what it means. He gives us some deciphering of these complicated visions. And in a way, what we understand about Daniel can be a guide for helping us understand some of what's in Revelation. And so I feel like it would be a shame to do this work and get through Daniel and not branch out to Revelation for a minute and try to tap into that, because that's free lunch, okay? This is a great opportunity to try to chip away at maybe some misunderstanding or some confusion that we've all had about some of the most difficult passages in Scripture. So Daniel's interpretations are going to be very helpful. There's also going to be extra-biblical knowledge of history. We can look at history now that we're, you know, over 1,000 years removed from when Daniel lived, and we can see how it aligns with some of his passages and some of his prophecies. And if you remember in the first class, one of the first critiques that I shared with you that scholars might offer against the book of Daniel is what? This can't be prophecy because it's too accurate. How could anybody get that right? That's way too accurate. Somebody wrote it after the fact. Kind of ironic that one of the most amazing aspects of Daniel's prophecy is also the very reason why some people choose to call it fake or to call it uninspired or something other than actual prophecy from God. And the last tool that I hope will help us is what we're going to talk about today. Just gaining some knowledge of the apocalyptic genre. What does that mean, and why do I care? We're going to talk about that this morning. But no matter what book of the Bible we're studying, it's always helpful, right, to try to consider what the original reader would have expected from it. What did the original audience take from this? That's always helpful to know, right? Because that helps us to frame our understanding of it. So let's talk about meanings for a few minutes. Does everybody, you know, agree with that? Does anybody disagree with what I just said? That if we want to know what Daniel really means, we need to try to understand what the original readers of it would have understood? Any potential problems that anybody sees with that? Yeah?
I don't know if it's exactly a problem, but there's only so much we can understand about how they would have understood it, right? So there's a limit to how much illumination that can provide when, whatever, 2,400 years on, we have kind of a limited scope in terms of what we can see and know about what was going on with them.
Sure. So Adam's point is there's a challenge for sure in trying to do that, because we've got to get from here to there, and from here to there is thousands of years. Yeah, Alan?
And even still, it's hard to understand what they would have understood. Some might have got it, some might not have. We even look at Jesus and his parables. He was straightforward, and they didn't understand.
Sure, so that's a great point too. Alan, if you didn't hear Alan's comment, he said, even when Jesus was on the earth, some of the people he spoke to in his time, in his culture, in his language, didn't understand what he was saying. So if we're going to try to find out what did the people who actually understood what Daniel was saying understand.
There you go. That's the good part right there.
Well, we have 2,400 years of history.
Sure. Yeah, that's one of those tools that we're going to try to use. So think about this for a minute. Just set Daniel aside. Think about the way you talk to people. Think about the way we communicate. Is that a true statement?
No.
No, why not?
Rarely does a restaurant inspire awe.
Yeah, rarely are you awe-inspired, right? But is the meaning true? Yeah. What's the meaning? If I say, Alan, that restaurant is awesome.
It's really good.
It's really good.
You should go there.
It means you should go there. Yeah. You would like it,
you
right?
Would recommend that restaurant.
Now, what's fascinating to me about this is that that's what I meant, and that's what you heard, but that's not what I said. Have I taken the temperature of that car?
Well, in fairness, Kurt, you have in the past taken the temperature.
Fair point. But if I say that's a cool car, I don't mean, that car is cool. Why is that? Why is it so much cooler than the ambient temperature? That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying I like to look at that car, and if I were driving it, I would know that people are looking at me. And the thing is, all of you heard all of that, and none of it is up there. You heard that meaning, and I didn't say any of it. And that's because we talk in hyperbole a lot. We use words that are reserved for the most maximum amount of that thing, like plummet. We throw plummet around, like the stock's just plummeted. Plummet means you're falling as fast as you possibly can. And we throw that out there like it's true. But really, what we're saying and what everybody else hears is this is, this is going down fast, right? Our language is loaded with that. And it's amazing that we're still able to communicate in some ways. So these statements that I just made are not technically true. If you were to try to decode them like a Latin sentence or something, and if you were a non-English speaking person and you had learned the English language, but you hadn't really learned how people use it, how people handle it, you would decode these messages and get the totally wrong idea, right? So there's an element of culture that has to be there. There's context, and there's familiarity with how things are said. And we're all making these interpretations on the fly, whether we know it or not. There are other things we say, though, where I think the meaning, it's a metaphor or it's a figure of speech, and the meaning can be derived, even if you're detached and removed from the culture. I'll give you an example, okay? Maybe some of you are thinking that this morning. I don't know. He's just full of hot air. What does that mean? Okay, you can't take what he says to be true. It's a funny one to me because it basically says there's no information worth having coming out of that person. It's just a bunch of air that's warmer than the air around it because it exited his body. That's all it's saying. But here's what's interesting about that. I think that comparison is kind of timeless. If you could translate those words into other languages, even other times, there's a chance that Daniel would have gotten that joke, right? Because humans have always spoke to each other. So this is one that can be derived. You can figure that message out if you're creative or clever enough. Here's another one. What does "don't burn bridges" mean? Don't kill a relationship, right? Sure, if you quit a job, you never know, you might be working for that same boss again in the future. Don't make him mad. Don't burn bridges. In the business I'm working in, if a client cancels your contract, you just, okay, no problem. Hopefully we'll get to work with you again in the future, because maybe you will. You don't burn bridges. That's another one that, sure is a good practice in general, right? Don't set fire to bridges. Somebody built it. It's there for a reason. People are using it. But if you are clever enough, you can decipher that. I would say that people, even in Daniel's time, if this figure of speech was ever uttered, they might be able to work out what it meant. People have been building bridges as long as they've been living around water. So, kind of timeless, right?
And you come and go both ways. You might be going back that same way and you'll need that bridge again.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what about writing that is so foreign to the reader that no amount of cleverness is going to help you work out its meaning? I had to jerk the wheel and slam on the brakes. You go back 200-300 years, try to get somebody to understand what that means. Why? Because there's words in it that didn't have any meaning back then. What is jerking the wheel? What are brakes? Why would you slam on them? What are you using to, what is, there's a time and a place, even today on the earth, where that statement wouldn't make any sense. Now, here's one that wouldn't have made sense 10 years ago. If you had said to me 10 years ago, did you see my post on Facebook? I don't know what that is. I actually remember where I was sitting when I first heard about Facebook. I remember where I was sitting when I first heard about Google. That was in 1999, by the way. I was sitting in Mr. Emerson's English class. And they didn't even have Google Maps yet. So there's words in our vocabulary that are being added on almost a monthly basis, on almost a daily basis, right? That aren't going to have any meaning. And it doesn't matter how clever you are. You're not going to be able to figure it out. Now tell me, which of those categories does this fall into? I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion, and had the wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground, and made to stand on 2 feet, like a man. A human mind also was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and 3 ribs were in its mouth, between its teeth. And thus they said to it, arise, devour much meat. After this I kept looking, and behold, another one, like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and 3 of the 1st horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boasts. Right, clear as mud, right? So where do you want to put that one? Okay, fictional fantasy, maybe. You would classify it that way, sure. Alan? Adam? Sorry.
Yes.
Adam, Alan.
That's all right. I call it Alan a lot. It's kind of all like of the various types of metaphor and simile we discuss, multiple categories kind of fit within here of things you can't understand and things you can't, no matter how hard you think about them. Knowledge can help you with some of them, but historians have shown that not all of this actually fits.
Sure. So it's kind of old.
Yeah.
Was the first thing you said, right? Yeah. Really, really, really different language and metaphorical imagery than you and I are used to using, right?
But you can see how it could have meaning or hidden meaning within it.
Right. I feel like this, I think this passage probably fits in a different, there's a different reason why we can't understand it just like that. And it's because we don't necessarily spend a lot of time in the genre that this kind of writing fits in. And that genre is apocalyptic. Mark Roberts has written a book called Understanding Apocalyptic Literature, which has been really helpful to me. And if that's the kind of thing you like to read as you're getting ready for bed, then I highly recommend it. It probably isn't. But it's been helpful to me in understanding a little bit more about what this genre really does for us. And he makes an analogy that I want to borrow and I want to share it with you because I think it's helpful. Everything that I just read is different than what we're used to reading. We finish it and we have lots of questions, right? Doesn't everybody have some questions when they finish reading a passage like that? Especially since it came from God. What is God trying to tell Daniel? Roberts makes this analogy. How many people here have ever gotten a sweepstakes mailing in their mailbox? Has everybody gotten one of those? Does everybody know what I mean when I say sweepstakes? I haven't seen one in years. It's been a really, really, really long time. But I remember when I was Reed's age, maybe ages like 6 to 12, sometimes this really thick envelope would arrive in our mailbox. And me and my brother loved these things because they had stickers inside them, and you were supposed to put stickers on different squares. And really what it was magazine subscriptions. But in big, bold letters on the front of these envelopes, it would say, you are a finalist in the $10 million sweepstakes, or the $30 million sweepstakes. And what's interesting is, I think everybody did basically the same thing with those, right? What did you do with them when you got them?
You mailed them back.
Oh, well, Alan mailed them back. Yeah.
I didn't know why.
Well, we usually pitched them in the trash because we didn't take them seriously. And the point that Mark Roberts makes in his book is that most people pitch them in the trash. Because you come to understand, if you want to apply the word genre here to maybe what you get in the mail, I mean, usually we use the word genre to talk about what? Books, TV shows, movies, music, entertainment. But genre just means a type or a sort of something. So sweepstakes, that's a genre of the mail that you get in your mailbox, right? And his point was, you know what to expect when you see that. You're familiar with that kind of mail, you don't expect it to really amount to anything, so you pitch it. Like I said, I haven't seen one of those in years. Apparently, that's no longer an effective way to sell magazines, or maybe magazines in general are on the decline. I'm not really sure, but I'll tell you something that is more modern that may also sound familiar. How many people have ever gotten one of those emails that says you're the heir to riches? You are the last surviving descendant of Sheikh so-and-so, believe it or not. What? Yeah, just send us your bank account so we can do a direct deposit. I've gotten a few of those. I think those are funny. But again, of all the stuff that lands in my email box, I expect certain things from that I don't expect from other things. And that shapes what I do with it. That shapes the meaning that I might take from it. I think we do generally the same thing with both of those examples. We delete them. And that's sort of a parallel to the genres that we see in literature. And the point that I think Roberts is making is the first people who read the apocalyptic writings in Daniel 7, similar to the first people in the first century who might have read John's Revelation. When they started reading it, just like we look at that envelope and we see signals, there are signals there of what is contained inside and what to expect if we keep reading. They saw some signals in the way these things are written. They saw these hallmarks of what we now call apocalyptic writing, and that sets the reader's expectations for what's about to follow and also what to do with it. And I'd like us to consider a little bit what that might have been. Because if we can set our expectations accordingly, I think we can extract the same meaning that was intended from some of these writings. This is a somewhat academic-sounding definition, but biblically, an apocalypse is a book that uses visions and dramatic word pictures to convey information about God's activity, particularly regarding the oppression of God's people by their enemies. Books that have this kind of common theme are called apocalypses or are said to be apocalyptic. So why do we care about this genre? Well, we already recognize that different books in the Bible are structured different ways, right? Psalms is not Romans. And if you try to read Psalms the way you read Romans, it wrecks its meaning. Psalms is poetic. It uses lots of metaphor, lots of similes. Romans is an epistle for the purpose of exhorting and admonishing, right? Now, that's not to say that apocalyptic writings can't do those things. Apocalyptic writings can exhort and they can admonish, but they do it with a different framework than something like an epistle or a gospel. So I think we already know it. You know, maybe you've never considered some of this before, or maybe you have, but you're already doing it on some level when you read the Bible, because you know that when you switch from an epistle to a gospel, or when you switch from an epistle to something in the Old Testament that's more poetic, you're not really reading it the same way. You're making careful judgment about what you're reading. Dwayne?
The word apocalypse literally means an uncovering. And as you suggested, it has come to mean something cataclysmic.
Right. Yeah, Dwayne's comment was the literal meaning of apocalypse is an uncovering, which is a perfect question to ask, because the next question I was going to ask is, what does the word apocalypse mean to you? Just throw something out there. What does apocalypse mean?
Disaster,
okay.
A movie that after the post-atomic age has destroyed the world.
A movie where the world has been wiped out. It's my favorite genre, by the way. I'm glad you said that. I love those movies. Yeah. In modern times, the word usually refers to doom and gloom, right? It refers to something terrible happening and completely changing the way of life for people. You know, in my lifetime, there have been two scenarios that I've witnessed where regular people were actually concerned like that. The first one was Y2K. Does everybody remember Y2K? There was like one gas station in my hometown in Virginia where the pump stopped working, but that was the extent of the damage. The other one was 2012. You know, that wasn't that long ago, about 5 years ago.
That was the Mayan calendar.
Yeah, the Mayan calendar, and, you know, people were making apocalypse jokes like there was no tomorrow. That's what appeared on my Facebook feed. Is there really? I believe it. Right, so we've still got people worried about Y2K. But those are the kinds of things that we typically apply to the word apocalypse. I think it's helpful, though, to know that as far as Bible study is concerned, this is really what is meant by apocalypse. It's helpful to know that, you know, in New Testament times, there were numerous apocalyptic writings already written. You know, you probably haven't heard of these. Second Baruch, Second Enoch, the Apocalypse of Abraham. Maybe some people have heard of the Apocalypse of Abraham, or the War Scroll. That pops up in studies of the Kings and Chronicles sometimes, and 4th Ezra. You know, there are some books out there that have survived, their manuscripts have survived, and digging into each of those writings is way beyond the scope of what I'm trying to do with this lesson this morning. But there's a couple of things worth mentioning. It's not believed that any of these other apocalyptic writings are inspired. If you read them, you'll find out why. Nobody thinks that they're inspired. But if you were to read them, what you would find is lots of language that sounds like it could have come straight out of the Revelation of John. There's stuff in there that sounds like it could have been written right along with everything else. And that's what the genre is really all about. It's saying, these things are the same, they have some of the same characteristics, now how can that help us? Here are some characteristics of this genre to think about. It claims to be from God. That's really, really important. There are books in the world, old manuscripts, that use the same imagery, the same cataclysmic types of stories to try to tell a narrative, but they don't claim to be from God. What Daniel is going to tell us, what I just read a few minutes ago in Daniel chapter 7, came from God. And Daniel says so up front. He says, this is God's message. There's also a story being told. It has a narrative framework. It's not poetry. It's not a set of instructions that's intended to exhort or admonish like an epistle might have. It's a story. Now, it can still exhort and admonish through that story. And oftentimes it does. But an apocalypse is always told in that framework. And a hallmark of these stories is that they have otherworldly beings. In the section of Daniel 7 I read a second ago, what are some of the otherworldly beings that you heard?
Beasts with
10
horns.
Beasts with 10 horns.
Horns with faces.
Horns with faces, saying things.
Dragons
are going to be popular in Revelation. Stuff that we don't see in this world, and people never have, are part of that vision. And to take that a step further, sometimes the apocalyptic story is being delivered to the prophet by an otherworldly being. Sometimes it's an angel. that is delivering this message. So that's almost always there. And lastly, and maybe most importantly, apocalyptic writing discloses a much bigger reality than what we are capable of understanding and sensing for ourselves. It tries to explain what is going on in heaven and what is going on in the battle between different spiritual forces by using the earth as a stage or by using a vision of something cataclysmic and apocalyptic happening on that stage. That's really the purpose of it, to convey that there is a bigger picture here, there is a bigger reality, and it stretches into the future. Maybe keep these characteristics as notes if you want to. Just have them handy. I can print them out and give them to you if you want. Because as we study Daniel 7 in depth next week, and as we continue to finish out the book of Daniel, and especially as we get into Revelation, I think you'll be able to look at what we're studying and look back at this list, and you'll be able to decide for yourself, am I reading something apocalyptic? You'll be able to make that distinction in the future. And that helps you place the writing within its correct context and helps us understand what it means. So how does it help us after all of that? How does this really help us? Well, it's been conjectured that the book of Daniel may have been one of the most helpful books to the Jews who entered into the centuries that exist between the Old and the New Testament. And just curious, who knows how long that was? How long was the intertestamental period?
400.
About 400 years, right. So it's thought that the book of Daniel, maybe more than a lot of other books, might have encouraged the Jews of that time. And we've just finished reading half of it. So imagine that you're a Jew entering into that time period, or you're living towards the end of it. What encouragement would you take from the book of Daniel? God delivers. Sure. Number one would be God delivers. Yeah. Yeah.
I think there's kind of two phases of this. God cares about individuals. So God cares about Daniel, protects him, and helps him in many ways. Kind of the first half of the book. Then the last half of the book has this idea of a broader help and a broader care and power for all. So God cares about you individually. But God also cares about you as a people, and the Israelites, the Jews, need to understand both pieces of that puzzle.
Absolutely. If you didn't hear Adam's comment, he's made a great point that you take the first half of Daniel, you can see God's care for Daniel as an individual, Daniel's friends as individuals. Second half of the book, maybe a little larger scope. It's talking about justice for God's people, right? The intertestamental period was full of persecution. And it's thought that Daniel's writings may have actually led to the writing of other apocalyptic pieces in that same style. And the reason is because, well, there's a few other. There's Isaiah, Ezekiel, Zechariah. There's a few sections in there that sound apocalyptic. But if you fast forward to the first century, so all of a sudden, there's a whole lot more apocalyptic literature available to people to read. Where did all that come from? It's thought that it came from that period, that 400-year period, and that it may have been sort of inspired by the way that Daniel wrote and the way these visions were given to him. So I'm not going to go so far as to say we're reading the original apocalyptic piece, because I don't know that, and I don't think anybody else knows that. But to me, that helps my study of it, and I hope it helps yours. It gives me a different perspective on what the book of Daniel is. So there's a big question that's left unanswered at this point. And that is, what would a first century reader expect from an apocalypse? That's going to be helpful to know when we take our detour into Revelation. The answer to that question is coming in a future lesson. I'm not trying to leave you with a cliffhanger. But I am trying to do way too much up here this morning, and I apologize for that. But I think it's going to aid our understanding of Revelation. So, you know, definitely something to look forward to. Just to kind of wrap this up a little bit, I appreciate I appreciate you hanging in there with me as I, you know, as I fire hose this stuff. I know it's a lot. It's been a lot for me to take in, but I hope it's been helpful anyway. So to wrap up, Daniel and Revelation both fall into this genre, and we've placed it in that genre so that it can help us understand it. It gives us clues about what the original audience might have understood and might have expected to read out of these passages. And if we can align our interpretation with what theirs might have been, we stand a much better chance of getting this right. And that's crucial, you know, for lots of reasons, but it's one of the most crucial reasons that I think affects us today is deciding for ourselves what we think about all of the premillennial concepts in the world. I'm not trying to beat that horse to death, but it's very practical and real for us. The premillennial concepts are something that I think it would help all of us to really know where we stand on. Donna and then Dwayne. I think it would have been easier for them, absolutely. And there may be situations, there may be passages where we just have to go, okay, I think I've pursued this as hard as I can, and I don't think I understand it, and nobody around me understands it. Maybe it really was just meant for the people that originally received it. Yeah, and I think that that's true in some cases. In those cases, I still think we can say, does it mean what these people think? Or does it definitely not mean that? You know, sometimes it's enough for us as Christians in the 21st century to be able to rule something out. It can be kind of frustrating because you're sitting here going, "I sat through your whole class. Tell me what it means." But right. Yeah. I'm going to try to make applications everywhere I possibly can without overdoing it and pulling applications out that really aren't there. You guys have to keep me straight on that.
Is it fair to say that the apocalyptic biblical literature is the story of a struggle and deliverance on such a grand scale that it is totally beyond any experience you've ever had?
Well, it's certainly beyond any experience I've ever had. That's for sure. I don't think I've ever been part of a people who were looking for deliverance as a nation, right? It would have had special meaning to the Jews for sure. And it could be that it's difficult for us to fully grasp that. You know, I think that's definitely possible. But I hope that just putting this in a little bit of context is helpful in our study. And the plan going forward is next class we're going to get into Daniel chapter 7. We're going to start with this very early apocalyptic text. And then the class after that, we're going to wrap up Daniel 7. And we're going to start thinking about Revelation a little bit. And then the class after that, we're going to use a combination of things to consider different interpretations of the book of Revelation and Daniel, these two prophecies. All right, thank you all for your comments and questions.